Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Welcome to Tuesday's edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody's off today taking care of other business. For all your gold and silver needs, call us toll free at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you news, opinions, and commentary on the economic and political events of the day for Tuesday, September 12th, 2023. Boy, I don't know about you. It's a gorgeous day in the waning days of summer here in southeastern Pennsylvania, despite some growing concern about the whereabouts of an escaped convicted murderer in the region. But that's another story for cable news. So instead, happy National Hug and High Five Day, which happens to coincide with National Day of Encouragement. Both of these celebrations are dedicated to uplifting people around us and making a positive impact. Encouragement is free. It never costs us anything to say a few words to inspire a student, a coworker, friend, or family member. Even a reassuring word to a stranger can make a difference in their lives. Encouragement lifts someone when they are down. It also motivates a person who has an eye on a goal, especially when we've failed at something. The right words remind us to keep trying, pick yourself up. Right message may just create a spark that changes a loved one's perspective. So today, give someone a hug or a high five. Not only will it make you feel better, it just may put that someone on a path to reaching their goal. Let's take a look at today's markets. First, in the precious metals in the New York spot aftermarket, we've got gold down $9.30 at a little under $1,914 an ounce. Gold was down as traders did some technical selling today while waiting for tomorrow's August CPI report. Silver up a tad, 2 cents, $23.17. Platinum up 11 bucks, about 1.2% at 920. And palladium, a good day, up almost 2%, 22 bucks, 1,274. Now, in other markets, let's look at other commodities first. Oil, domestic West Texas intermediate crude futures up almost 2% today. It just hovering below 90 at $88.96 a barrel. International Brent still slightly above $90 at $92.20. That was up 1.72% today. The dollar index, not surprisingly, was up slightly, up 0.17 to close at 104.74, the USDX. Natural gas up real big today, 5.3% to close at $2.75 roughly. In the Treasury markets, bellwether 10-year yield down a couple, a little over basis point, right now at 4.27%. The yield curve inversion is still pretty steep, 2-year at 5.02%. That was actually up a tad today, as was the shorter term 3-month at 5.4%. In the paper markets, Dow Jones was a little up, a little down today, closing down about 18 points, 34,646, we'll round it to. NASDAQ down 144 points, a little over a percent. Traders worried about this Google trial, antitrust trial that I'll talk about in a minute, that closed at 13,774. We'll round that too. And the broader-based S&P 500 down 25 and change to close at 4,462. Other international markets were largely down, although the FTSE was up 30 points. The Nikkei was up about a percent. And the VIX Volatility Index actually up about 3%, but still at a relatively modest 14. So that will do that for today's DGS Coins Market Report, again brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Some interesting news out there today. The Kremlin confirmed that North Korea dictator Kim Jong-un arrived in Russia's Far East this morning. At the same time, dismissed Washington's warnings about Putin's forthcoming meeting with Kim. Kim traveled to Russia on an armored train, apparently only goes 37 miles per hour, for a one-to-one meeting with Putin that will likely take place today or tomorrow at a location that has not yet been revealed. Now, Kim, I believe, is in Vladivostok, where the Eastern Economic Forum is taking place this week. That city is on Russia's Pacific coast, just about 80 miles from Russia's border with North Korea. The U.S., well, bear with me here. Sorry about that. The White House has warned that arms negotiations between the North and Russia have been actively advancing in recent weeks. It says Moscow aims to buy weaponry from Pyongyang for use in the Ukraine war, which both Russia and the North deny. U.S. Repeated warnings to the North yesterday not to send any arms to Russia. I doubt that will be listened to. Reiterated, the U.S. did that any arms deal or support for Russia's war in Ukraine would directly violate a number of U.N. Security Council resolutions, especially the prohibition of all weapons trade with them. The U.S. added it's ready to impose more sanctions against North Korea if there is such a deal. Kremlin Press Secretary Dmitry Peskov dismissed the U.S.'s warnings, however, telling reporters that Moscow and Pyongyang are just not interested in warnings from Washington. Meanwhile, German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock said Berlin is encouraging its partners to deliver any available air defense systems to Ukraine ahead of winter. She said, we have to build a winter shield of air defense systems all across Ukraine's critical infrastructure. Baerbock said Germany would be making more Iris-T missiles available to Ukraine in the coming months. The foreign minister visited Kyiv yesterday and said that while Ukraine's place was in the European Union, more needed to be done to tackle corruption in Ukraine's capital city. Here in the States, come as no surprise that child care is already scarce and expensive, and the stakes are about to get higher. Federal government provided states with about $24 billion in funds to keep child care services open as part of the American Rescue Plan of 2021. Well, that program expires at the end of this month. And more than 70,000 child care providers who benefited are said to be likely to close as a result of lost funding. That's according to the Century Foundation. That would affect over 3 million kids, they say, and slash over $10 billion in revenue from lost worker productivity as parents are forced to reduce hours or leave jobs as they scramble to find new care. Researchers came to these figures based on a survey of 12,000 early childhood educators from all states and settings, as well as data from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Lauren Hipp at Moms Rising Together said, quality, affordable childcare is already scarce, and the childcare workforce is already badly underpaid and under great stress. So as pandemic relief runs out, all that is likely to get worse. Well, the share of working mothers with young children is at historic levels, exceeding other working-age women's labor participation growth from 2020, the Hamilton Project found. However, experts are concerned that this loss of childcare options will pull more people, especially women, back out of the workforce. Experts say that systemic change like broader parental leave and more public funding for childcare must be involved for childcare to improve on a large scale. In this divided Congress, I certainly don't see that happening anytime soon. Hipp added that childcare providers want to be able to support families but can't make it work on the amount they make. The hourly wage of a child care worker last year was $13.71 an hour, which equates to $28,500 roughly per year. That's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. According to public policy professor Taryn Morrissey at American University, if you work in a preschool private child care center versus a kindergarten classroom, that wage differential is huge. Teachers, she says, in elementary, middle, and high schools generally make higher salaries, while kindergarten elementary school teachers roughly earned $61,600 last year. High school teachers made a little bit more, $62,400. Plus, teachers enjoy an array of good benefits, such as health insurance and retirement plans, while oftentimes pre-K, early care, education workers don't. And parents often deal with early childcare costs when they are at the lowest earning years of their careers, without low-interest loans or subsidies to lean on. There's always mom and dad, I say. The national annual cost of childcare was about just a little under $11,000 for one child last year. That's according to Child Care Aware of America. This year, two-thirds of parents spend 20% or more of their household income on childcare. Now, while childcare issues financially impact women, the economy also takes a hit. When parents don't have access to affordable, reliable childcare, the U.S. loses around $57 billion a year in economic productivity and revenue, tax revenue, according to a report from a Council for a Strong America. Thus, it seems that what the Fed has managed so far to avoid in its campaign to lower inflation – that is a big hit to jobs. The end of pandemic funding for childcare could end up doing just that. Interesting ironies. Hey, concerns over a potential government shutdown have reached a fever pitch this week as the U.S. House returned to session today with little progress to show on 2023-24 budget negotiations. As we've talked about, government funding is set to expire in just a couple of weeks on the 30th, leaving less than a dozen working days for both chambers of Congress to pass all 12 appropriations bills and the president to sign. So far, the Republican-led House has only managed to pass one. And a failure to do so would result in a government shutdown, leading to furloughed workers, agencies closed, and many essential programs placed in limbo. No surprise that deep divisions remain between the parties, with Republicans looking to implement large spending cuts that are unlikely to pass in Democratic-controlled Senate. The White House last month called on Congress to pass a short-term continuing resolution known as a CR to keep government funding at its current levels while negotiations lag on. The House Freedom Caucus, which includes the most conservative members of the Republican Party, is looking to cut spending for fiscal year 2024 to $1.47 trillion. That's about $120 billion less than what Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy agreed to in May when the two sides last sparred over budget talks. That demand is a non-starter, though, for both the White House and Senate leaders, including Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who said last month that budget negotiations were, in his words, a pretty big mess and predicted a CR would be passed. The Senate may have bipartisan support for that short-term stopgap funding bill, but it's a tad more complicated over in the House. Freedom Caucus members have said they'll oppose even passing a CR without concessions on border funding, which they want more of, and if it includes money for Ukraine, which they want less of. Some harder-line Republicans were holding out support until McCarthy agreed to launch an impeachment inquiry into President Biden, which he announced earlier today. But Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia said she wouldn't vote on any necessary budget bills unless impeachment proceedings began. Republicans supporting the impeachment push remain murky on what high crimes and misdemeanors the president has actually committed. McCarthy, we know, is in a difficult, hard-to-win situation. He is beholden to the needs of every member of his caucus, including the hardliners of his slim 10-person majority in the House. And that was on full display at the beginning of the session when it took 15 ballots and a number of concessions to elect him speaker. Not all members of his caucus, however, have signaled they're on board for impeachment. Ken Buck of Colorado, who's a member of the Freedom Caucus, called the situation absurd. He added, the time for impeachment is the time when there's evidence linking President Biden, if there's any evidence linking President Biden to a high crime or misdemeanor. That doesn't exist right now. And it really is something, he continued, that we can say, well, in February, we're going to do this. It's based on the facts, and you go where the facts take you. Meanwhile, ladies and gentlemen, the funding clock is ticking. In a story somewhat related to the coming child care crisis, child poverty in the U.S. more than doubled and median household income declined last year as pandemic government benefits expired and inflation kept rising. That's according to figures released today by the Census Bureau. At the same time, the official poverty rate for Black Americans dropped to its lowest level on record, and income inequality declined for the first time since 2007, at least when looking at pre-tax income. Income inequality actually increased when using after-tax income, another result of the end of pandemic-era tax credits. The reports reflected the sometimes conflicting factors last year buffeting American households, which faced a robust job market, the number of full-time workers increasing year over year, but also rising inflation at the end of the pandemic stimulus benefits. Hey, we'll finish up this story when we come back. That music means we're up for our first break. Please stick around. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back to Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Look us up on the web at dgscoins.com, dgscoins, one word, .com. While you're there, sign up for our weekly newsletters and blogs. They're free, and they're informative, too, if I must say so myself. Hey, right before the break, we were talking about the rise in poverty since the end of the pandemic era, government benefits. In response to the pandemic, the federal government expanded the child tax credit and sent stimulus checks to people who had suffered from it. And that both them combined lowered poverty measures in 2021. Now, the expansion of the child tax credit expired at the end of that year, and other pandemic-related benefits have expired within the past year. As a result, the supplemental poverty measure for children jumped 7.2 percentage points to 12.4% last year. That would mean what? It was 5.2% in 2021. So that more than doubles the rate. Now, Leanna Fox at the Bureau said this represents a return to child poverty levels prior to the pandemic. We did see the child tax credit had a substantial decrease in child poverty. Now, the median household income in 2022 was about $74,600, a decline of 2.3% from 2021. Asian Americans had the highest median household income at almost $109,000, while Black Americans had the lowest at about $53,000. The official overall poverty rate was 11.5% for Black Americans, 17.1%. That's the lowest on record. And the supplemental poverty measure was 12.4%, an increase of 4.6 percentage points from the prior year. The Census Bureau releases two poverty measures. The official poverty measure is based on cash resources. The supplemental measure includes both cash and non-cash benefits, as well as subtracts necessary expenses like taxes and health care. Now, we know that Google has exploited, the Department of Justice has charged, though, and today is opening the biggest U.S. antitrust trial in a quarter century, that Google has exploited its dominance of the internet search market to lock out its competitors and smother innovation. Ken Dintzer, who's the Justice Department's lead litigator, said, "This case is about the future of the internet, whether Google's search engine will ever face meaningful competition." Over the next 10 weeks, federal lawyers and state attorneys general will try to prove that Google rigged the market in its favor by locking its search engine in as the default choice in a host of places and devices we use. U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta likely won't issue a ruling until early next year. If he decides that Google broke the law, another trial will decide what steps should be taken to rein in the company. Top executives at Google and its corporate parent Alphabet, as well as those from other powerful tech companies, are expected to testify in the trial. Some for Google, most opposed. Among them is likely to be Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai, who succeeded Google co-founder Larry Page 4 years ago. Court documents also suggest that Eddie Q, a high-ranking Apple executive, might also be called to the stand. Now, the Justice Department filed its antitrust lawsuit against Google about 3 years ago, charging the company has used its internet search dominance to give an unfair advantage against competitors. The government's lawyers allege that Google protects its franchise through a form of payola, shelling out billions of dollars annually to be the default search engine on the iPhone and on web browsers like Apple's Safari and Mozilla's Firefox. Dintzer said Google pays more than $10 billion a year for these privileged positions, adding that Google's contracts ensure that rivals can't match the search quality ad monetization, especially on phones. Through this feedback loop, he continues, this wheel has been turning for more than 12 years, always turning to Google's advantage. Dintzer also claimed that the more searches Google processes, the more data it collects. And that's data that can be used to improve future searches and give it an even bigger advantage over its rivals. He said user data is the oxygen for a search engine. Well, I'm not sure where this is going to go. Dintzer says the Google began weaponizing defaults more than 15 years ago and cited an internal document calling its arrangement an Achilles heel for rival search engines offered by the likes of Yahoo and MSN. He also charged that Google strong-armed Apple into giving its search engine a default position on their devices as a condition for getting revenue-sharing payments. Dintzer said, this isn't a negotiation. This is Google saying, take it or leave it. So litigators argue the company's anti-competitive tactics prevented Apple from developing a search engine of its own. And Dintzer said that Google deleted documents to keep them out of court proceedings and sought to hide others under attorney-client privilege, saying they destroyed documents for years. They turned history off so they could rewrite it in this court. Google counters that it faces a wide range of competition, despite commanding about 90% of the internet search market. Google argues that its rivals range from search engines like Microsoft's Bing to websites like Amazon and Yelp, where consumers can post questions about what to buy or where to go. From Google's perspective, continual improvements to its search engine explain why most people reflexively keep coming back to it, a habit that long ago made Googling synonymous with looking things up on the internet. Now, observers say Google could be hobbled if the trial ends in concessions that undercut its powers and market share. One possibility they note is that the company could be forced to stop paying Apple and other companies to make Google the default search engine on smartphones and computers. Some might characterize that arrangement as a bribe. Others, just a business deal, where we give money for consideration of another service. Well, the 2024 election cycle, and I'm really sorry to be reporting this one, is expected to be the most expensive of all time for political ad spending, totaling $10.2 billion across all media. That's according to new projections out from Ad Impact that were released today. $10.2 billion. That figure would exceed by more than $1 billion, the current record, which was set during the 2020 election cycle when then-President Donald Trump lost his reelection bid to Joe Biden, when the Republicans took over control of the U.S. House and the Democrats retained its control of the Senate. Previous election cycle in 2016 totaled a measly $2.6 billion in political ad spending by comparison. Well, Ad Impact projects that the 2024 cycle will show a 13% increase from just 4 years ago. Now, the figure does include political expenditures across broadcast, cable, radio, satellite, digital, and internet-connected TV. The group anticipates that at least $7 billion of the 10.2 total will go toward TV ad spending. So my TV watching peeps out there, be prepared for the coming onslaught. More than a quarter of the 10.2 total, $2.7 billion, will come from presidential ad spending alone. Most of that chunk, Ad Impact says, $2.1 billion is expected to be spent during next fall's general election campaign. But Congress is hardly expected to scrimp. The Senate's projected to shell out $2.1 billion in ad spending this cycle, while the House, $1.7 billion. Gubernatorial ad spending, however, is expected to decline compared with the 2022 cycle, mainly because half as many seats are up for reelection. Now, through August 2023, we've seen $652 million, and are pacing 75% ahead of 2019 and 16% ahead of 2021. Ad Impact says the off-year of an election cycle traditionally receives between 10 to 14% of total spending for the two-year cycle. Now, how much of these numbers will come from organizations funded by so-called dark money? Was not calculated. Dark money funds, as we occasionally talk about, funds a growing portion of campaign spending across the country, thanks to the Supreme Court's 2010 decision known as Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. A 5-4 majority of the court then sided with Citizens United, ruling essentially that corporations and other outside groups can spend unlimited money on elections. The term dark money refers to the fact that the organizations, known as super PACs mainly, that provide campaign financing don't have to report the names of their money donors, thus casting a dark cloud over our entire electoral and, I might add, democratic process. Oh, boy, did you see this? I mean, first, there's the wildfires in Lahaina, Hawaii, then the devastating earthquake a couple days ago in Morocco, and now more than a minimum of 1,000 people have been killed, at least 10,000 missing in Libya in floods caused by a huge Mediterranean storm that burst two dams at least, swept away buildings and wiped out as much of as a quarter of the eastern coastal city of Derna. That's in Libya. Officials expect the death toll to rise much higher after the storm Daniel barreled across the Mediterranean into a country divided and crumbling after more than a decade of war. In Derna, a city of around 125,000 residents, journalists saw wrecked neighborhoods, buildings washed out, cars flipped on their roofs, and streets covered in mud and rubble left by a wide torrent after dams burst. More than 1,000 bodies have already been recovered in Derna alone. Bodies were shown lined up on the street outside a crowded hospital, with residents looking under the shrouds covering them in search of loved ones. Similar devastation reigned on the way into Derna, with vehicles overturned on the edges of roads, trees knocked down, houses inundated and abandoned, and bridges crossing the rivers totally wiped out. Libya's Minister of Civil Aviation said shortly after visiting Derna, bodies are lying everywhere, in the sea, in the valleys, under the buildings. He added, I'm not exaggerating when I say that 25% of the city has disappeared. Another official later told Al Jazeera he expected the eventual number of dead across the country to reach more than 2,500 as the number of missing people rises. Other eastern cities, including Libya's second largest, Benghazi, were also hit by the storm. A member of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Society said the death toll there would be huge. He added, we can confirm from our independent source of information that the number of missing people, in fact, is hit is 10,000 so far. UN aid chief Martin Griffiths said that emergency teams were now being mobilized to help on the ground. As Turkey and other countries rush aid to Libya, including search and rescue vehicles and teams, rescue boats, generators, and food, distraught Libyan citizens rushed home in search of their loved ones. You could send a donation to the International Red Cross to help displaced Libyans as well as Ukrainians and residents of Lahaina and Maui. Just go to www.redcross.org. and specify where you'd like your donation to go. Hey, central bankers have made it a habit over the years of clearly signaling what they're planning to do before they do it. Well, this week, the European Central Bank's trying something different. EC policymakers meet Thursday in Frankfurt, and it's a genuinely open question for the first time in a while whether they'll raise interest rates again or stand pat. ECB watchers rate the odds as something close to a jump ball. That's 50-50 in basketball parlance. In contrast to their Fed counterparts, who've made it clear they won't raise rates next week, ECB officials have gone out of their way to be non-committal, something they explicitly agreed to at their last meeting in July. Now, it's said that their reticence reflects the global economy's changing era, where central bankers don't particularly trust their own macroeconomic models, and big shocks are commonplace. Eurozone growth has been sluggish, I mean, suggesting earlier rate hikes are slowing demand and bringing down inflationary pressures. But inflation remains far above the ECB's 2% target and is forecast to remain elevated next year. So the July ECB policy meeting said broad agreement prevailed that ahead of its September meeting, the governing council should neither hint at further rate increases nor signal that it would pause in hiking rates or that it had reached the peak rate. Well, officials have stuck to that plan, for better or for worse. In her Jackson Hole speech late last month, ECB Pres Christine Lagarde offered a conceptual overview of the challenges of setting policy in a world of supply disruptions and higher inflation pressure. But she was essentially silent about the ECB's next move. Piper Sandler analysts said, unlike the Fed, the ECB provides nary a whiff of next steps. I like that phrase. Lagarde's self-professed data dependence is uncontaminated by any substance beyond we don't know. Adding, no wonder Lagarde's Jackson Hole speech wasn't exactly illuminating on near-term policy, calling this week's policy decision a toss-up. They ended by saying her ruminations on clarity, flexibility, and humility read more as a motherhood and apple pie manifesto than any blueprint for the remaining tightening cycle, other than to distinguish the ECB from any central bank that instead endeavors to be obtuse, intransigent, and arrogant. Hey! We're off for another break. I hope you're going to stick around. We got more coming back in the third segment. In today's financial survival.
Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. For all your precious metal needs, call us at 1-800-375-4188. Now, as we know, Fed Chair Jerome Powell is responsible, along with other members of the Federal Reserve, for setting their benchmark interest rate, among other things. Interest rates have a profound effect on the nation's economy. They drive the stock, bond, and precious metal markets, borrowing activity, the liquidity of funds, inflation, and more. In this way, you might say that Powell and company control the finances of the U.S. to a certain degree. Well, Powell has been Fed chair now since February 2018. And according to multiple sources, including CAKnowledge.com, Powell's worth about $55 million, making him one of the wealthiest individuals to hold the Fed chair position. Born in 1953 in Washington, D.C., to wealthy lawyer Jerome Powell and his wife Patricia Hayden, Powell has five siblings. He attended Georgetown Prep School and then was accepted into Princeton, where he earned a B.A. in politics. He went on to Georgetown University Law School to earn his law degree in 1979. While there, he was editor-in-chief of the Georgetown Law Journal. He went on to a career in law from 79 to 84, and then left to embark upon what would become an on-again, off-again career in investment banking. He first entered politics in 1990, serving in several roles in the nation's capital. Some of the titles he held included Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Finance and Undersecretary of the Treasury. Then in 1977, he went back to investment banking as a partner in the Carlyle Group. He left there in 2005 to found Severn Capital Partners, a private investment firm. A couple of years later, became a managing partner for the Global Environmental Fund for Private Investment and Venture Capital. Powell's early legal and investment jobs certainly gave him plenty of resume building experience to ultimately be appointed as Fed chair. He's a registered Republican, is often praised for his bipartisan attitudes and policies. He was initially appointed as Fed chair by Donald Trump, replacing Democrat Janet Yellen, who had been nominated by then President Barack Obama. From 2010 to 12, Powell served as a visiting professor at the Bipartisan Policy Center, a Washington think tank. To his credit, the affluent Powell accepted just a $1 stipend as his annual salary with the center. That position, by the way, proved crucial to the country, in fact, for his positive reputation, as he used his connections and knowledge to convince a Republican Congress to raise the government's debt limit after the 2011 debt ceiling crisis. Although some would tend to disagree with that, I'm sure. He left his career on Wall Street to join the Bipartisan Center and then was appointed to the Fed as governor during Obama's presidency. In January 2014, Obama nominated him for a 14-year term, which expires in 2028. I don't believe they can be reappointed. As chair, he oversees the Federal Reserve Board of Governors and the Fed's 12 regional banks, which have a combined 21,000 employees and who were paid an aggregate of $2.8 billion last year. The Federal Reserve System's annual budget calls for total operating expenses of $5.6 billion this year, 5.5 increase over last. Its 2022 annual report showed the Fed holding over $8.6 trillion in assets and liabilities. Interestingly, it holds about $11 billion in gold certificates as collateral for its notes, a figure that hasn't changed really since the early 2000s. Now, according to one source, the Fed's chair salary in 2023 is $226,500, while other Board of Governor members earn close to $200,000. All board members are nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate and are considered government employees. However, most employees at the Fed are not government employees, and their salaries and wages are set by the district bank where they work. The Fed itself is self-funded and generally keeps the profit it makes each year from interest on trading U.S. government securities and foreign currency transactions. Interestingly, the pay of the presidents of the Fed's 12 regional banks, a lot higher, range from about $429,000 in St. Louis and Kansas City to $529,000 in New York Fed. By comparison, the president of the U.S. gets paid $400,000 a year plus $50,000 in expenses, the VP around $255,000, and members of Congress $174,000 a year plus a per diem expense. The median pay for the country's top CEOs is well over $20 million a year. But beyond pay, Powell reportedly has $9 million in cash assets, which would cover most household emergencies. He has a stock portfolio of around $23 million, according to a source. Income from those investments and other endeavors gives him an annual income exceeding $4 million. Plus, Powell received an inheritance of about $16 million from his family's estate, further solidifying his financial security. Now, when you have millions in savings plus investment income, you can afford to indulge in your passions. One of them, a pal, reportedly owns more than 25 luxury watches, including a vintage Rolex Submariner, which he's seen sporting occasionally on interviews. Submariners range in price from just over $9,000 up to $42,000. In addition to his watch collection, Powell owns as many as 11 cars. Without the years, it's difficult to estimate the retail price of those vehicles. He and his wife live in Chevy Chase, Maryland, where they purchased a home in 2006 for 3 million Zaporuskis. Today, Zillow has the home estimated at about 5.1 mil. The home apparently boasts two swimming pools, a tennis court, bowling alley, and state-of-the-art security and safety systems. Liberty Net Worth reports that Powell sometimes rides his bicycle to work, which is about 6 miles to his office in D.C. Interesting stuff, wouldn't you say? Well, alas, our latest American Survival newsletter has hit the streets. It features Doug Nolan's weekly Credit Bubble Bulletin blog and Apothecary Herb's Wendy Wilson's Food for Thought and how the lack of sleep affects our brains. And I have a piece on debt. Well, now that we know that the nation's red ink is wet, we also know it's not drying anytime soon. The federal government will run a deficit of about $2 trillion the year that ends this September 30th, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Axios's Courtney Brown and Neil Irwin, who I'll refer to as B&I, write that understanding why that's happening is key to revealing something important about how inflation and debt interact. They say it can sometimes seem like a burst of inflation is a get-out-of-jail-free card for a highly indebted government. Inflating away debts can sound like a way to reduce the real burden of previously accumulated debt with one weird trick. Well, for everyday Americans, that's a possibility. For a government with a fiat currency, it's different. It's apparent when you look at how much of the surge in the federal deficit is either directly caused by high inflation or indirectly the Fed's obsession to whip it into shape. In effect, B&I claim, a good portion of the doubling of the deficit this year is paying the piper for the inflation of 2021 and 22. Those federal government outlays are real, not nominal. Higher inflation means higher Social Security, Medicare, Medicare costs, plus everything else the government spends money on. In addition, higher inflation usually leads to higher interest rates and higher debt service costs. That is the interest payments on the debt as a result. That occurs when the Fed raises rates to reverse higher inflation or because bond investors believe higher inflation will stick around and thus demand higher yields for their increased risk. So why are deficits higher? Well, as of July 31st, the federal deficit was $891 billion higher than it was at the same time a year ago. Higher Social Security spending, primarily due to the 8.7% increase in retirees' monthly benefits to keep up with rising inflation, is responsible for $111 billion of the increase. Medicare and Medicaid account for a combined $133 billion, while higher interest payments on the nation's gross $32.9 trillion of debt, reflecting 11 rate hikes, are responsible for $146 billion. A particular note, as of July 31st last year, the Fed had returned $99 billion to the Treasury from its massive portfolio of Treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. But now, with higher interest rates, the Fed's paying banks interest on their reserves, and that's all but wiped out those profits. And as a result of its quantitative tightening program, by which it's been offloading its bond portfolio, the Fed's balance sheet has fallen $854 billion from a peak of $8.965 trillion last April 2022 to $8.1 trillion as of last Wednesday. Other factors contributing to this year's higher budget, ones that are actually less directly tied to inflation and the monetary tightening it triggered, are a $284 billion drop in tax payments driven largely by lower capital gains tax receipts caused by, well, the steep stock market correction last year. That was partially offset by a $113 billion increase in payroll and withholding taxes, reflecting strong wage gains. Altogether, FY23 tax receipts will have fallen by an estimated net $171 billion. And look, don't forget about the FDIC's extra outlays this year, contributing $52 billion to the higher deficit because of the bank bailouts this spring caused by rapidly rising interest rates. Most of those funds are expected to be recouped, however, by asset liquidations and additional fees on bank deposits. And a pandemic employee retention tax credit, which we've seen a lot of commercials on TV for, claimed by businesses, is responsible for another $99 billion. And last but least, there's been a reduction of $81 billion in revenue from the FCC's auctions, Federal Communications Commission auctions for broadband spectrum. As Mark Goldwein, pardon me, at the Nonpartisan Center for a Responsible Federal Budget says, inflation giveth and inflation taketh away. One-time surprise inflation can help reduce debt in the near term, he added, but things have a way of catching up, and now we face higher spending, lower revenue, exploding interest costs, and rapid growth of our federal debt. That's nothing. If you think our level of national debt is stunning today, hold on to your already frayed hats. For an apples-to-apples comparison, let's look at debt held by the public, which is about $25.5 trillion, or 95.1% of GDP as of June 30th. It was roughly 105% at its 2022 peak. About 7.6 of the 25.5 is held by foreign countries. Now, the difference between gross debt and debt held by the public is the amount of debt held by government agencies like the Social Security, Disability, and Medicare trust funds. Well, CBO projects that based on the continuation of existing policies and economic assumptions, debt held by the public will grow to 100% of GDP by the end of 2024. 115% by 2033, 144% by 2043, and an astounding 181% by 2053. That averages out to about an annual increase of about 3% over the next 30 years, again, based on current policies and economic assumptions. And the major ones, major assumptions over that 30-year period include average annual GDP growth of 1.6%, CPI inflation of 2.3%, and PCE, Personal Consumption Expenditure Index, the Fed's preferred measure of 2%, is the Fed's long-term target. And we know how stable those policies and assumptions can be. Thus, I'd look at these debt projections as a baseline, as a minimum level. What's more, remember the debt of state and local governments, a combined $3.6 trillion today, corporations at least $10.4 trillion, and individuals $24.7. We live in truly unsettling, uncertain, and confusing times. Hey, it's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back Thursday. Butch will join Melody tomorrow, along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. Thanks, as always, to our production engineer, Todd Waite, and to you, our loyal listeners, tuning into Financial Speak. Please be safe out there. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.